one of the first evidences of conservation was when Yellowstone National Park was set aside in 1873. A government expedition was sent out to look at the area, possibly to see what could be exploited out there because of these boiling hot springs and geysers and whatnot. And they came up with the idea, not of exploitation, but of preserving all of these wonders for all of America. Any one of those men could have said, well, let's cash in on this thing. Let's put a fence around it and charge admission. But they had the first vision there of trying to preserve something for all the people. And that idea there, plus the Yosemite idea, which was before that in the 1860s, was the beginning of the national park system in this country and all over the world. And even after Teddy Roosevelt did what he did, and after the national park system was set in motion in 1916 by congressional act, there was still almost a half a century of lethargy and objection by the people who were imbued with the whole idea of exploitation, devil take the hindmost, get what you can and get out. Conservation as an idea has really come into its flowering in the last couple of decades. For the first time, we can talk about pollution of air and water and soil, or noise pollution. For the first time, we can talk about natural beauty without being branded an aesthete. These things have come out in the open. That's why the time for this sort of thing is now. Because all of these things are on everybody's mind right now. We talk about spending billions for pollution control and billions for noise control or water control. 10 years ago, it would have been impossible. People are willing to do it now because they realize their environment is threatened. And if we don't do something, this won't be a very happy place to live in. But in the last analysis, these are national problems. And the gross national product has just got to move into this thing to make it possible. The private individuals can do a whale of a lot by writing their congressmen, by joining conservation groups, by making their voices heard and felt, which they're beginning to do all over the country. The one difficulty of getting anything done is getting wide public support. Within a decade or two, possibly 90% of our people will be living in urban communities. In spite of our commitments, our foreign commitments, these things should have very high priority for several reasons. One is our population explosion. We're beginning to face up to that now for the first time. The last 10 years, we know what the population explosion is going to mean to America and to the whole world. From that standpoint alone, we have got to preserve the livability and accessibility of our countryside now, or we'll not have a chance to do it later. This is particularly true of the wild natural areas, which are disappearing at the rate of, a million acres a year. By the year 2000, demographers say that we'll have 400 million people here. The ball is rolling, and it won't change. We're going to have between 350 and 400 million people living in the United States. What's that going to do to the availability of such lands? There's an urgency about it today. A decade or two and you'll never have a chance to set aside another county park, state park, or national park, or preserve of any kind. You've got to do it now. In other words, the chips are down. You cannot expect a second chance. This isn't just a short-term proposition. We hope that in the year 3000 or 4000, Americans will still have a chance to enjoy these things. Humans are like all other animals. They cannot be crowded. They cannot be faced with the possibility of having no place to go. If they are faced with it, they will develop the same sort of trouble that the lemmings develop before they migrate. The lemmings, according to physiologists and ecologists, develop cancers. They develop inflammations of the mucosa of their intestines. They develop ulcers. They develop kidney trouble. They become irritable. They snap at each other, even eat their own young. So they say to themselves, let's get out of here. Let's move. I don't care where. They start off by the millions, head off toward the sea, plunge out into the waves and drown. What humans are going to do if they reach that sort of thing, what's happening to their insides will be somewhat like lemmings, but we always do things better. So far, we've been running high, white, and handsome, disregarding the pollution that we're causing or the destruction of the environment as a result of it. And we hope that the urban communities will be made as livable as possible. An attempt is being made to make these cities beautiful. But in addition to the cities, there's this inherent love and feel of the open countryside, which is just as important, because they've got to escape the artificiality and get back to nature. It's hard to say which season I like best. The spring is always exciting because after a long winter, when the warm winds begin to blow in March and early April, you get all excited inside. And when the ground begins to show patches of brown and the deer are moving out and the birds coming back, there's a time I love too. I love to hike in the springtime before the ice goes out. Just before the ice goes out, it becomes crystalline and hard, and you can hike anywhere on those lakes without any trouble at all. It's a time of year I love. And then when the first buds begin to come out, the first aspen with their Nile green, and the birches begin, the tops of them begin to turn rosy, and the dogwoods begin to blaze, and all the little flowers are coming out, and the creeks are running, and the fish coming up to spawn, in spite of the fact that I've seen it almost countless years, I get just as excited as I ever did. Say to myself, this has never happened before. And then, of course, summer. I love to swim, I love to paddle, I love to travel everywhere by canoe. I've got a little sand beach out of my cabin, and it's a wonderful place to swim. You hear the loons call in every night and every morning. And the whole season begins to sort of come to maturing. The birds are there and singing, and there's always life about. Everything is growing. Then you move into the fall. And when the colors begin to change, each fall I say to myself, they've never been as bright as they are right now. The other day when we got back from the east, the first thing my wife and I did, we hadn't been home 24 hours, and we threw an outfit into the canoe and went out to the Island River, about 20 miles from home. And the Island River in the fall is solid gold. Golden rice, golden aspen, golden tamaracks. Everything is gold. And the last night we were out, it snowed. And when the snow covered all that gold, it was really a fantastic sight. The pure simplicity of snow and pines and spruce and the wide open lakes. I love the winter. The stars at night, you get a display of the constellations and the heavens in the wintertime that really gives you something. I quote from Plato. He was standing on a point of land near Athens one night, and he saw a constellation. And he said, there are two stars up there. I am standing on the point of a great constellational pyramid. My point is the most important point in the world to me. From this point, I can survey the whole universe and also my own soul. So, at my cabin, which is a point in time from which I can see Orion and Venus and all the rest of them, concentrated on that point, as I stand, I can survey my own thoughts, my own spirit, my own soul, and still see the whole universe. I'm an ecologist. Most of my life I've studied human ecology, social anthropology. The more you study man and the evolution of mankind, the more you realize the truth of what I'm going to say. Man has been evolving for a million years, maybe 2 million years, maybe 100 million years. In other words, we humans today have come a long way. But only in the last 10 to 15 or 20,000 years have we begun to emerge as men with minds and perception. But we have inherited all of this background. Physiologically, psychologically, we are at one with the whole animal kingdom. We have matured from primitive beginnings and arrived at the space age with psychological and physiological and spiritual complexes within us, which we cannot shed. Deep in our subconscious is this racial pool of experience. This racial pool of experience determines what makes us happy and what we need. We can't forget it. Each one of us have it. Native people, for centuries, lived in harmony with the land. Perhaps they didn't realize this harmony, but at the same time, there was a definite feeling of oneness and reverence for the land and all its creatures. And when the harvest came and they gathered in their corn, they did this with reverence and with joy and thankfulness to the Creator who made it possible for them to have this harvest. It's that giving thanks, that reverence, that understanding, that feeling at one with the spiritual heritage of the race, which we have lost in our manipulation of the land or our use of its wild creatures. For the first time, man has emerged as a geological force, which is having the same impact on the land as the glacier had 10,000 years ago. We are doing things to the land for the first time in our history. And for the first time in our history, we're faced with combating our own inventive genius in destroying the only planet we'll ever be on. This is still the place where we're going to live. This is our Earth. And I wonder if the day isn't going to come sometime when we can live more in harmony with our environment, more in harmony with our resource pattern, get away from the idea of waste, replace to the earth what we take out. In other words, act as though there was a reverence for the land, a reverence for all of its resources, a reverence and love for the whole ecological complex from which we sprang. And until the human race catches this sense of belonging and oneness, we will not be a happy people. No people is happy unless it learns to live in harmony with the earth. We better take care of it, not for us, but for our children and our grandchildren and their children. We're planning for the future. If we don't take care of us, future generations will look back and say, just think of the heritage that was left for us. I think we've got to decide pretty soon what our values are. What is important? Is it important to have increased luxury, increased automation, increased material wealth? Or is it important to be happy as a people, to feel rich inside, to like the places we live, to like the country we live? I think it's important to be able to sing the songs we do about America the Beautiful and really know we mean that. I think it's important to preserve the beauty and the ancient rhythms and develop a living place where we and our children can be happy. I hope that we will have an America not only that we're proud of, but that the whole world can look to and say, look what this culture has done. Look the place that they've made for themselves to live in. Those are the important things. When man loses his feeling of belonging to the earth, his feeling of continuity with all life, and with the earth processes themselves, he is cutting his spiritual roots, a tie with our primitive past. The psalmist, when he said, I lift up mine eyes to the hills from whence cometh my help. When Isaiah said, woe to the man who builds house to house and lays field to field, lest there be no place for him to be alone. It is the truth. They were thinking about that several thousand years ago. Now we're faced with it. I think of the historian Trevelyan, who said, we are children of the earth, and removed from her our spirits wither and go awry. He spoke the truth, because we are children of the earth. We came from the earth. We live on the earth, and we'll return to the earth. And if we remove ourselves too far from nature, too far from the earth itself, we are removing ourselves from the ancient ecology of which we once were a part, and of which we still are a part, even though we may be living entirely different than our ancestors were. Man's relationship to the land is a deep one, an inherent one. The enjoyment of a land, no matter where it is a feeling of being at home, a feeling of being a part of rocks and trees and waters and wildlife, a feeling of not wanting anything more. So my little point out there, beautiful as it is, and I've kept it very primitive, very unspoiled. When a tree dies, I don't cut it down. Things are just as they were. I use it as a sort of a place to come and think and meditate. I'll get out there and walk around my point and look at the rocks and the pines and listen and get the feel of returning, the feeling of contentment. And that's what I get up in that country. I think that if more people could develop that feeling, they'd be happy wherever they lived. One of the great advantages anywhere of living close to the earth is getting this feeling of contentment and satisfaction. If combined with their great love of an area, they could also have reverence for the land itself and all it means. There wouldn't be questions of despoiling the land or polluting it or destroying beauty, because inherently, as Aldo Leopold once said, if you have what's known as an ecological conscience, a feeling within you that you cannot do the wrong thing as far as the land is concerned, with a conscience regarding your behavior toward the land, you are its best protector if you feel within yourself that you are part of the land. This ecological conscience goes far beyond expediency. It's a matter of ethics and morality and wanting to do the right thing. So if we can build up in the human mind this sense of responsibility and stewardship and wanting to save and wanting to preserve, then we have accomplished our purpose. The wilderness is for everybody, because the wilderness has a humanitarian impact on the human mind that nothing else does. People who don't know what they're looking at nevertheless reach way back into time and catch this elusive something which is part of their subconscious. They may think, oh, isn't this wonderful? But actually, it's far more than that. They have touched home base through the millennia with their subconscious past. They have become one with their racial memories. They have reached out and come in contact with something far deeper than they comprehend. And they carry it away with them when they go back to their apartments or wherever they live. And sometime in the future, whatever they've gotten from that will come out and give them sanity and balance if the going gets too swift or ferocious back in the towns. I believe that unless we give the wilderness concept that sort of breath, we'll never save it. We're saving it for all America. I think wilderness, whether it's large wilderness areas or little pockets of wilderness, any natural areas, wherever they might be, are going to serve as points of focus, nuclei of sanity and equilibrium in a madly worrying technological age. No tension, no pressures, no competition, no great wants. When we get back to the wilderness, this matter of timelessness begins to take hold of us. Watches aren't important anymore. Stars and the moon and the setting sun are all the time that you need. watches seem ridiculous. And one of the great things that man can get out of a wilderness experience is coming together with this old matter of timelessness, beginning to adopt the seasonal rhythms rather than the artificial rhythms of a clock. Now people will say, well, we can't all go to the wilderness. We can travel for a month or 3 months or four back in the bush. The point is, you don't have to do it. Fine if you could, but you can capture this sort of thing and become a part of it and sense it. But even looking across a wilderness valley, or going for a quiet walk, or sitting on a lake shore and looking out across it where it's quiet, with the ability of our minds to encompass and perceive, I think that people can get much more out of areas of natural beauty. You don't have to climb Mount Everest. You don't have to go on a 1,000-mile canoe trip. But you can do all these things if you're aware of what it means, and aware that there are a multitude of impressions and influences welling up from this great reserve of racial experience. Then wilderness might really come to mean something to him. The human mind is the most wonderful development in creation. We are the only creatures who can look at other creatures with perception and understanding, or look at ourselves and have dreams. That human mind should be able to figure out somehow how to live.